Chapter 1. The Devil's Hideout. In front of the bar sport, Jorge enjoys a cold beer in the solemn tranquility of a Saturday morning. By now, the economic crisis spares no one, not even the most popular places, yet this decrepit bar is still standing. It has already been 3 years since he first set foot in the so-called paradise. Coming directly from the favela where he was born, Lemos de Brito, on the outskirts of Rio, with the last money he had left in his pocket. The money he had hidden in a cigar box under the magpie tree, in the devil's hideout. Over 50,000 reals. A fortune. And yet, in this tiny country nestled in the heart of Europe, Jorge was just a poor man. Because this is a paradise only for those who have money, power, and the right contacts. So he could do nothing but take the usual path, that of crime. But thanks to his talent, he quickly managed to get involved in certain traffics, and now knows all the different groups in his branch, clients of all kinds and of course the cops and their secrets. Politicians, officials, and even judges never refuse an envelope full of money to turn a blind eye. He doesn't care if those who do business with him are rich, powerful, dangerous or ordinary people, he cares about making a profit. Whoever has money in hand is welcome, they are his client. From a friend in the police, he learned that even here they have nicknamed him El Arasau, the great flying thief, or more simply, Ara. He doesn't care about being put under close surveillance, on the contrary, it makes him feel even more proud. His friend is called Gregor Rossi, and he is the head of the city's police. By day he does his job, he is highly respected by the people, by night he is one of his many clients. One of the skeletons, as he calls them, who live a secret life in the darkness of the Locarno's pit. Jorge knows their dirty games well, and they can no longer touch him because if he goes down, half the country goes down with him. Surviving in the favelas of Rio made him a real man. The years spent in the drug trade prepared him to be a leader. The cops here are just puppets, inflated balloons. The children of the favelas are sharper than all the cops in paradise. Many, from the age of 6 and up, lose all fear by becoming couriers for the dealers. Jorge was one of them too. At 8 years old, he already knew everything about that maze of narrow alleys and dangerous nameless streets. He still remembers the smells coming from the mud used to build the houses. The acrid stench exhaled in the heat from the dumps. But also the sense of the food that many cooks, with the skill of true artists, manage to prepare from nothing to feed their children. Because many are born in the favelas, and just as many die quickly to make room for the next. He remembers the smell of detergents mixed with feces and urine, running through pipes or improvised channels, to then collect in holes around the lower built houses. Waste of all kinds formed rivulets in the middle of the small streets. The poor in the favelas are not entitled to a long life, but their life has a price. Their brief journey ends in the pits that fill the cemeteries on the hills. Graves dug and reused many times, often without a headstone or even a cross. Only the wind from the sea, strong and salty, whistles, calling out the names of the dead. In Lemos de Brito, the people are poor but laugh often. Even in misery, they take advantage of every opportunity to celebrate, dance and bring life to the guitars and tambourines found in almost every home. They savor the little sweetness that remains in the bitterness of their fate. Those who have a job feel happy and strive every day not to fall into the traps that are hidden everywhere there. The luckiest find a place in the city, working as domestics in the affluent neighborhoods of the middle or upper class who can afford them. Or they work as bricklayers, carpenters, glaziers, tailors, or do all kinds of manual labor. Others manufacture tools or materials needed to build houses and shacks. Mountains of bricks made with mud await to become the walls of new houses, along with mountains of metal objects, glass, and other materials extracted from the dumps that surround the city. But many turn to crime. They deal drugs and weapons, produce strong, often poisonous alcohol. In the favelas, you can find everything, even the worst type of crime, mercenaries ready to kill for a few reals. Because here crime is a malignant cancer, and it spreads abundantly. Jorge was born in the worst part of the favela, in the only room of his grandmother's house, who died long ago from AIDS. He never knew his father, his mother never even uttered his name. Like many women left alone, she sold her body to earn some money. Just enough so they wouldn't all die of hunger. Jorge was sharper than his peers, and she sent him out on the street to steal a few reals wherever he could. He always found new tricks for his thefts, and often wandered around the artisan square, which with its Portuguese-style buildings attracted many tourists easy to rob. And it was there, one day, that he had a strange encounter with a bird he had never seen before. All black but with a white belly, white patches on its sides and wings, and a very long tail. It was a magpie, as the barber who had a shop in that square later told him. That bird flew low and passed right in front of Jorge before perching on the roof of an old house overlooking the square. The boy watched it curiously. It seemed to be eyeing a group of tourists just like him. It was staring at a blonde woman at the back of the group. Precious earrings dangled, shining in the sun. Jorge observed them, preparing to rob her. But the bird was watching them too. The blonde woman didn't notice the many miserable, hungry eyes watching her, even from above. Now was the right moment. Jorge quickly approached her from behind, but just as he reached out to grab one of the earrings, that bastard bird swooped down from the roof, claiming its loot with a cry. Jorge stopped abruptly, frightened by the unexpected sound. The woman also froze. Then, everything happened quickly. The bird aimed precisely at the right earring and tore it painfully from her lobe without interrupting its flight. No one seemed to notice it. Except for the barber, who was smoking a cigarette in front of his shop at that moment. The tourists only saw Jorge with his arms still raised and the woman screaming and clutching her bleeding ear. Jorge stared at the magpie flying away. It was clear to the tourists, who surrounded the dirty-haired, tattered-clothed, dark-eyed and cunning child. The woman seemed to go mad and wanted to grab him, screaming, "Thief bastard, stop him!" Jorge, on the other hand, looked at her with innocence, paralyzed by danger. Then he heard the barber's voice shouting, "Kid, run!" So he turned quickly and ran into one of the many alleys leading off the square. The same one where he had seen the magpie disappear with its loot in its beak. He could still see it up high, but now he had to think only about hiding. He looked back, hearing the tourists still shouting, "Stop him, stop that bastard, stop him!" Then he lost sight of that bird, smarter than him. The barber, standing at the door of his shop, smoked and enjoyed the spectacle. The next day, Jorge stole 2 radios and some shiny objects, glass beads and fishing lures. The barber had explained to him that the magpie is called a thief because it has a habit of stealing shiny things. And so he decided he wanted to outsmart it. His friend Raffaele, in agreement with him, sat at a table in Artisan Square, spreading out all those stolen things in front of him. As if hearing a call, the magpie returned and comfortably perched on the roof of the same house. It had already spotted what it could steal today. It was eyeing those glass beads and lures. Jorge imagined that the light reflections on the surface of those objects were very attractive to it. Jorge signaled his friend to move away, leaving the table free to encourage the magpie to come closer. Meanwhile, he was ready to chase it. That bird was clever, but Jorge was even more so. The magpie, as expected, swooped down on the table like a kamikaze. It snatched one of the beads in midair and immediately fled in the same direction as before. Jorge saw it flying between the rooftops and managed to chase it for a while. Then he lost it. But within a few minutes, the flying thief returned. Jorge knew that such a rich loot would attract it. This time, the magpie took a lure, and Jorge tried to chase it again, but he was quickly blocked by a car stopped in the middle of the street and lost sight of it again. 5 minutes later, the magpie was already back. But this time, almost before it could steal two lures from the table, Jorge was already running after it as fast as he could. Now he could see it clearly and wouldn't let it escape. He ran a long time, sweating in the hot air under a merciless sun, and finally saw it slip into what seemed like a kind of forest. Jorge knew that place. They called it the Devil's Hideout. A small green island in the middle of the Morro do Fubor favela, a territory reclaimed from the forest in recent years that had quickly filled with illegal houses and shacks. The hideout was a tangle of trees and bushes that seemed impenetrable. Not even a path could be seen to get through the plants. Because of certain strange beliefs, no one had touched that patch of forest. The inhabitants of the surrounding houses were, in fact, frightened by some strange events that had happened, so much so that they were convinced that the devil himself lived there. More than once, it had happened that amulets and crucifixes, placed at the windows of the old and sick to protect them from evil spirits, mysteriously disappeared. Then maybe, by pure chance, those poor souls died the following night, and so people began to remember noticing a black bird flying in and out of that thicket. They had seen it near the houses of the sick, just before the amulets disappeared. They didn't know that it was simply a magpie, irresistibly attracted to those sunlit objects during the mating season. Surely, though, its black feathers stirred their superstition. Thus, they began to say that it must be the devil who, during the day, took the form of that bird to fly and find a victim whose soul it would come to steal at night. In a short time, the Green Island thus became the devil's hideout. Many took the elderly and sick to other distant suburbs, safely to the homes of relatives or friends. And those who couldn't leave protected themselves as best they could, maybe simply nailing the amulets and crucifixes to the windowsills. Jorge had never believed in superstitions. He knew they were just tales created by simple people. He didn't believe in the devil or in angels, only in himself. He also didn't believe in God, and had always tried to stay away from the church and its theories. Since he was a child, he had seen too many things that were wrong, poor children being exploited, sometimes even abused by priests whom people in the favela called angels. He was only 5 years old when he forever lost the ability to believe in any religion. His mother wanted to send him to help Armando, Raffaele's older brother, who on Sunday mornings went to prepare the church for Mass. The two brothers, who had grown up with Jorge, were the sons of a friend of his mother and lived in a nearby house. Jorge didn't want to go to church because he preferred to spend the day with his friends. Even Armando's mother insisted, pushed by the priest's requests. She was very religious and keen to do anything for the church. But Jorge kept refusing, even though he got beaten for it by his mother and stepfather. He resisted and said no, he didn't want to go, because he knew that the priest did strange things to his friend Armando in the room behind the sacristy, and he was scared. But his mother couldn't believe it. What did he know? How could such things come to his mind? Didn't he feel ashamed to speak like that about an angel like Don João Lavados? And she gave him more beatings to punish him for these obscene lies, ordering him to shut his mouth. According to her, He was making up these stories only because he was lazy and wanted to spend time with his thief friends. But they weren't lies. It was Armando who had made him understand what was happening in the church on Sunday mornings. He had often hinted at the priest's strange requests, at the room where he took him, without finding the strength to say more. He blushed, lowered his gaze, and almost choked with shame. And Jorge knew it was true. Armando wasn't as strong as him. He had a good heart and never said no. He kept going to that church to prepare it for the holiday ceremony. But Jorge had noticed that his friend, always cheerful and ready to tell a funny joke, had become increasingly silent and sad. He had lost his smile and hardly spoke to Jorge anymore, who saw him getting thinner and dimmer day by day. 2 months later, when Armando had just turned 7, the tragedy happened. They said that on that day, the boy had gone to the usual Sunday appointment, early in the morning, as the priest wanted. But this time he had brought his father's weapon, a large caliber pistol. Because his father was a well-known drug dealer, one with many souls on his account. He had the weapon in a backpack, where his mother always put something nice to bring to the priest. Entering the room behind the sacristy for the last time, while Don Lovato sat as usual in the armchair, Armando put his trembling hand in the backpack and pulled out the pistol. Perhaps they stared at each other in silence for a long moment. 5 shots exploded in the priest's body. The first in the head, then one in each hand, then one in the heart. Perhaps Armando had fixed his gaze on that now unrecognizable face before firing the last shot, straight into his groin. Immediately after, the boy put the weapon in his mouth and pointed it upwards. He had seen his father do it to force a client to pay a debt. He fired the last bullet into his brain, making it explode like a cloud. They found him collapsed at the priest's feet, in a pool of blood. His face was gone. The people, shocked, said that this poor priest, this angel, had been massacred by a devil's child. The way he had killed him, as if he had been crucified by those 5 bullets, was a clear sign of the child's diabolical madness, they said. Don Lovato's had been made to sit in the armchair, without his ceremonial robe, and, even more frighteningly, with his pants down, naked from the waist down. It must have been a blasphemous ceremony thought up by that crazy child to cover the priest with shame. When they found him, Armando still held the pistol in his hand. Perhaps, Jorge thought, he wanted to feel protected even where he was now. A crime like that had to be the work of the devil, who had acted through that little monster. The naivety of the people who believe in evil will always find a sinner to blame. This time it was an innocent child, whom the people described as possessed. They even asked his mother to pay for the priest's funeral. Only a grand ceremony could atone for her son's sins and cleanse the memory of that holy man from shame. Since Armando's death, Jorge no longer believed in any religion or God. He trusted only his group of friends, who had saved him from death, prison, or false angels like that priest many times. Today, he only trusts those he has known for a lifetime and who have shown through their actions that they are as loyal as his deceased friend. The only time Jorge had helped Armando in the church, he remembers, he ordered him not to go into the room behind the sacristy for any reason, even threatening to beat him if he did. It was the only way he had to protect him. In the end, the boy's mother had paid to save her son's soul from the people's condemnation. It was rumored that she had shelled out a large sum. Now she could attend the service, just like her good husband. Naturally, the priest's funeral was held in the church where Armando had taken his own life. Among the faithful who filled it, there were many who bought drugs from the boy's father. In his long and moving sermon, the new priest did not use words of forgiveness. On the contrary, He said that Armando and his family were condemned by the same madness. So, no one bought drugs from the father anymore because they feared being infected by evil. Soon, even Armando's mother died. According to rumors, her husband had killed her, strangling her. It wasn't clear whether it was because of the money she had paid to the church or because he blamed her for everything, the disaster caused by their son, and the ruin it had brought to his business. The woman, however, had a free burial. Jorge left those memories behind, returning to reality. He had to manage to get into that jungle-like area, the devil's hideout, and find the magpie. He struggled through the plants, tearing leaves and branches, trying to carve a path. He felt the bushes scratching his arms and legs, but as he went further, the vegetation became less dense, and he could walk more easily. Meanwhile, he kept looking up, searching for the magpie. He had seen it hop onto the branches, and then reach a tree that was now right in front of him, in the center of a sunlit clearing. It looked much older than the others, with a very tall and sturdy trunk. Jorge saw the bird arrive with something in its beak and slip into a crack in the trunk. Then it slid out again and flew away. So he climbed up and easily reached the open gash in the bark. He pulled himself up with his arms, a couple of meters from the ground, and managed to look inside the trunk. What he saw made him scream. The bird had accumulated a real treasure in there, in what must have been its nest. A truly impressive loot, a mountain of objects that at first glance seemed to be gold and silver. He picked up a large, heavy, and truly incredible ring. It had to be platinum or white gold, and had many diamonds set in the shape of a heart. It was definitely a gift from a thief or a drug dealer to some lover. And then there were precious necklaces and earrings, among which he seemed to recognize the one stolen the day before from the blonde tourist. But in the nest there were also amulets and small shiny metal crucifixes, glass objects, the marbles he had used as bait, and pieces of other worthless materials. Jorge pulled out handfuls of those objects, letting them fall to the ground. As he grabbed them, he realized that some jewels were fake, made of gilded plastic, but it didn't matter. Once he climbed down the tree, he took off his sweaty shirt and threw all that treasure into it, even the worthless things. Separating the valuable items from the others, Jorge went to sell them on the black market. They brought him 5,000 reais. A real fortune for an 8-year-old boy. Sure, they had tried to cheat him on the value of the goods, but he had already accounted for that. Anyway, that money would last him a long time. Because he wasn't one to get drunk or party with friends, nor did he sniff glue gel or other chemical vapors, crack or cocaine like many others. These things didn't interest him. Instead, he dreamed of becoming rich enough to buy one of those white houses in the wealthy neighborhoods near the sea. With the money he made, Jorge first went to his mother and gave her 1,000 reais. But he immediately regretted doing so. He found her lying on the bed with a man, and they both seemed drunk or under the influence of some drug. She took the money without saying anything, counted it, and then, instead of thanking him, screamed that he was cheating her, that he was surely hiding who knows how much more money. She knew her son well, she shrieked. Then the man with her, a so-called uncle, one of those who paid to be in her company, got up from the bed and immediately got involved. He had broad shoulders, reeked of alcohol and sweat, and seemed out of his mind. He started slapping Jorge, demanding to know where he had hidden the other money. Jorge swore there was no more, said he had found the money in a bag left on a restaurant table. The uncle, after beating him under the mother's bored eyes, took the 1,000 reais from her hands, with the excuse of wanting to keep them safe, then pushed Jorge to the ground and ran off into the street. He was surely going to get drunk or find a dealer. The mother then started screaming again, mad for having lost the 1,000 reais. Who knows how much money you're hiding from your poor mother? Thief bastard. Jorge looked at her without even listening to her insults, almost not hearing her. Meanwhile, he made a pact with himself, or maybe with the devil, and swore that from that moment on he would never think of others again, would not be guided by feelings anymore, because they only created problems and made him weak. So, with his mouth bleeding from the blows he had taken, he left that house forever, not knowing that it was the last time he would see his mother. He met Raffaele in an abandoned house near the ruins of a church. He too was used to running away from home, and they often did it together. He, Armando, and Jorge, when their fathers or stepfathers drunk beat them for no reason, shouting that they were useless hungry bastards. Raffaele and Armando were the only ones who knew everything about Jorge. But now Raffaele was the only one left to care for him, and always helped him. He did so even this time, bringing him food and something to cover himself, so he could sleep there that night. The next morning, he said he had found a place for him to stay for a few days. A friend of his, the barber, could host him at his house. He always did it willingly, to help children forced to live on the streets. Jorge agreed, knowing he could trust Raffaele. It was that barber who had encouraged Jorge to run away after the theft from the tourist. He lived above his shop in Piazza dell'Artigiano and was named Rodriguez Ferreira, but his friends called him Rod. A big man with a thick dark beard. Jorge had seen him many times and they had become somewhat friends, but he had never talked to him much because he found him intimidating. In reality, although he had a deep voice that made the air tremble, Rodriguez was a kind man who loved to laugh heartily and make malicious jokes about his clients. He was born in Spain and had moved to Brazil many years before, for love, he said, never adding more. He seemed to be a friend to everyone in the community, perhaps thanks to his charm and discretion. He could tell who was a good person and who was a criminal or a dealer, who had many lovers and who suffered for love, who was in debt and who was a murderer. Because while he cut men's hair or beards, they talked, maybe too much, perhaps just to show off. But all those secrets, he made sure to clarify, he never revealed to anyone. The sin is confessed, not the sinner. Raffaele knew him well, because his father also frequented that shop, and always brought him along. So he had asked Rodriguez to help Jorge, knowing that otherwise his friend would never ask anyone for help. And in that house, for the first time, Jorge felt safe with an adult who treated him well and didn't ask for anything in return. His mother had never been kind and affectionate with him. She only wanted him to go out all day stealing, and if he didn't come back with some money, she beat him. Or she had one of the many drunken or drugged uncles who came to the house beat him. One evening, while chatting with Rod and Raffaele, Jorge said that he had a great idea. "What idea?" Raffaele asked, intrigued. "I thought we could get help from the magpie." "To do what?" asked the barber. "To steal." "And how would we do that?" Raffaele said. "We could train her," Jorge replied resolutely. "Train her?" said Raffaele, who perhaps didn't know what that word meant. "Yes, we can teach her to steal from the tourists here in the square. So she will do it for us." Now his friend understood and seemed excited by the idea. "She doesn't attract attention, and above all, she can fly away quickly without getting caught," Jorge explained. Raffaele stared at him, mouth agape. The barber, however, remained silent, eyes lowered to the table. Then he said, "This doesn't seem like a good idea." And he said it seriously, with a worried voice, as if he wanted to immediately dampen Jorge's enthusiasm. "No, kid, this idea isn't good. He raised his eyes, locked them with Jorge's dark, surprised ones, enjoyed a moment of silence, and then added, "This idea is simply brilliant." He then burst into a powerful laugh, slapping both of Jorge's shoulders. The next day, the two friends went to a junkyard, where Jorge found exactly what he needed, an old mannequin, the kind used in clothing stores. Raffaele helped him hang glass marbles, pieces of metal, and fake jewelry they had found in the magpie's nest on it. They then set it up in Rod's kitchen near the window, so the magpie could see it. And so, the next day, the magpie began flying closer and closer to that shiny mannequin like a Christmas tree. First, it perched on the balcony railing, then made a few hops on the floor. Jorge and Raffaele watched from a corner of the room, holding their breath. The magpie grew more confident, and in the following days, it entered through the window, began hopping on the mannequin, and started picking off the jewelry one by one. To better train her, Jorge dressed the mannequin in some old barber clothes and slipped objects into the pockets so they could be seen just a little. The magpie had to learn to remove them quickly and fly away. They continued like this for many days. Just opening the window, and the magpie would come to take something from the mannequin. A few seconds, a flutter of wings, and she was already far away. But Jorge wasn't satisfied. He put on the mannequin's clothes and remained still, waiting. When the bird landed on him, he moved suddenly and made it flee. But those shiny objects were too attractive for the magpie. She had to have them. And slowly she learned to remove them almost without making a sound. The training lasted a couple of weeks. Then Jorge said it was time to put the flying thief to the test. He made all the baits disappear, and when the magpie returned, she seemed amazed, not finding anything near the window anymore. She stayed on the balcony railing for a while, then began to scan the square and the people crowding it. Jorge and Raffaele kept an eye on her, admiring the speed with which she pounced on her prey. Surely it wasn't as easy as robbing a plastic mannequin, but the magpie had learned to do it quickly and with a light touch. And above all, Jorge had taught her to steal coins and banknotes as well. For almost 2 months, the system worked great. The magpie managed to pull off at least a couple of heists every day. The loot became increasingly rich, and Jorge had found a perfect place to keep it safe. Right under the magpie's nest, in fact, hidden among the roots of the tree, there was a deep hole, perhaps the den of some animal. It was big enough to hold a cigar box, inside of which Jorge kept the money stolen by the magpie and the money he made by reselling the jewels. No one could imagine that in the devil's hiding place there was such a treasure. All those thefts alerted the police, who soon made various attempts to take down that bothersome bird that annoyed tourists. But then it was enough to pay the officers what they asked, 1,000 reais a month, and they left her alone. Suddenly, however, the magpie was nowhere to be seen. Jorge feared they had killed her, waited a few days, and then, not knowing where to look, went to her nest. He discovered that the flying thief had found a mate and was preparing to start a family. From that moment on, for months, she was no longer seen, and so, with no more income, they consumed much of the accumulated money. Then, one day, the magpie finally returned to the square. But soon the policemen also returned and began to keep an eye on her movements. And one afternoon, as the barber recounted, they took a rifle from the car and shot her with the first shot. There had been many complaints from tourists, they said. But Jorge knew it wasn't true. They had killed her just because he couldn't pay the increasingly high protection money demanded by the chief of police, a certain Rodolfo, an unscrupulous type who also took money from drug dealers. It was really a bad blow for everyone. The two friends had become attached to that intelligent animal. But the barber took it badly too. During work breaks, he liked to sit in front of his shop with a sandwich or a coffee, watching the spectacle of the thieving magpie. He was admired by the skill of little Jorge, who alone had managed to teach her how to steal from tourists. It was he who gave him that nickname that he still carries today, El Arasau, or more simply Ara. In fact, Rodriguez liked to tell stories to customers and often started repeating the one about little Ara and the magpie. He told it for a long time, and the customers who thought it was some kind of fairy tale asked him what that strange name Ara meant. The barber then explained that it came from the Spanish word Araca, meaning thieving magpie, adapted in Portuguese, while El in Spanish meant the great, and was used for important characters. El Arasau, therefore, meant more or less the great flying thief, and was meant to indicate the cunning of that child, comparable only to that of the magpie. Jorge was wanted, and staying in that house was a risk, and he didn't want to take advantage of Rodriguez's help by putting him in an uncomfortable position. So he did what many children in the favelas do when they are abandoned by their families. He slept wherever he could, sometimes on the street, sometimes in an abandoned house. He continued to steal from tourists when the opportunity arose, but he had to be very careful because the police were keeping a closer eye on him than before. The proceeds from stealing from tourists were not enough to pay off the bounty on his head. So, to make more money, he and Raffaele decided to get into the drug trade. They became two of the many Ninos that the organization hires as couriers of all kinds. Because children are agile, quick, and good at hiding in the labyrinths of the favelas, they are perfect for that line of work. So Jorge also solved the problem of the bounty on his head, because he was now automatically protected by the organization, which paid a fee for each member. Jorge quickly realized that he made more money with drugs than with theft, and he began to study the drug dealers to understand the various levels of careers in that profession. The older boys, from 10 to 13 years old, were simply called men by them. They used them as shields to protect the group and as drug dealers. They were the first to die in case of clashes with other groups, always fighting to control drug trafficking in the favelas. Then there were those 14 years and older, called uncles, who took care of everything that needed to be done in the organization. Surviving beyond 20 years in that circle was a real miracle, and only the strongest and most ruthless managed to do so, becoming the leaders of the various groups. These were called godfathers, as in the movies about the mafia. Jorge was smart, and even in those affairs he showed that he knew what he was doing. He became a highly respected Nino by his peers. But this wasn't enough for him. He quickly grew tired of being a courier. He wanted to move up, he wanted to become a drug dealer, and he aimed even higher. By now, he knew all the men in the group that controlled his neighborhood. One of them, a chubby drug dealer named Polita, seemed really unintelligent and kept a lot of coke for himself. So, Jorge began stealing a small amount of cocaine from the package he brought every week. That idiot never checked the weight, blindly trusting. For several weeks, the trick worked without any problems, and Jorge managed to resell the stolen drugs in another favela. But one day, just as he was taking the usual amount of powder, the package fell to the ground. He picked it up immediately, but the strong wind that day blew away almost a third of it in a few seconds. Jorge panicked. Then he thought he could replace the missing powder with white flour. He didn't yet know what they cut cocaine with. So, Jorge marked the end of the supplier and together the end of the drug dealer. Polita noticed the deception and showed up at the supplier's house, known as the Rotten One. He had a gun in his hand, high on coke, and wanted to make him pay. He hadn't thought that it could have been someone else, a Nino like Jorge, who had fooled him. As soon as Polita saw the rotten one, he shot him 3 times, but the latter, before falling, managed to fire back and hit him in the head. The next day, Jorge found their bodies lying in the entrance of the house. He had gone to get the packages to deliver to the various drug dealers. He didn't think twice, and asked Raffaele to help him make the corpses disappear. That night they loaded them one by one into a wheelbarrow, covering them with dirt, branches and weeds, and took them to the devil's hiding place, which fortunately was very close to the house. They dug a small pit and dumped them inside. Jorge and Raffaele settled in the rotten one's house, pretending to be his assistants. They had found the supplier's money in a hiding place in the house. A mountain of money. With that, Jorge thought they could pay for the first drug supply. With the profits from selling cocaine, they would pay for future supplies and so on. Jorge was still young but thought like an adult and had clear ideas. He wanted to become the new supplier in the neighborhood. At first, he feared that someone from the organization would ask about the rotten one. But no one ever came looking for him. All they cared about was that the coke was sold and the percentages due to the bosses arrived regularly. Everything went smoothly, and business grew quickly because Jorge increased the number of drug dealers by hiring his group of friends. Then he thought of involving Agent Rodolfo, the chief of the policemen at the time of the thieving magpie. He paid him to ensure freedom of movement and protection in that small territory, and to eliminate the nuisance of rival drug dealers, whom the police arrested one by one. Of course, the fee was commensurate with the favor. And so the territory he managed to control grew more and more. He also began to make contacts with larger suppliers. They were tied to very dangerous groups, but as long as they received regular payments, they behaved more or less. Aura continued like this for several years, making money in a relatively quiet manner. His business grew, and so did his power, which became greater every year. Weapons also began to play an increasingly important role in his life. He learned to use them with the help of Agent Rodolfo, who took him to shoot far away from the favela, among the graves of an abandoned cemetery. Jorge also proved to be good with a gun, so much so that he could shoot accurately using both hands. Raffaele was his right-hand man, always by his side. They trusted each other like brothers. But one day, shortly before his friend turned 16, fate decided to separate them forever. Raffaele was killed by the group that controlled the Villa dos Mineros neighborhood, near the west area of Rio. Jorge was also in their sights because, obviously, his success bothered many. Poisoned by anger over the loss of his only remaining friend, and feeling alone and in danger for the first time, Jorge locked himself in his house for a few days, trying to find a way to get revenge. He thought of proposing a fake peace to the leader of the Dos Mineros, whom everyone called Minus. He had remembered the story of the Trojan horse that Barber Rodriguez had told him years before. So, Jorge decided to sign that peace pact by giving Minus 12 bottles of smuggled premium bourbon. One of his boys, who kept an eye on the Godfather's house with binoculars, radioed him at the right moment. So, Jorge and 2 of his men entered the house while the boss, his henchmen, and the bodyguards were completely drunk. They killed them all mercilessly. Jorge shot Minus between the eyes. He owed it to his friend Raffaele. So, even that neighborhood ended up under his control. Jorge was now known by everyone as El Arisao. Over time, his power extended to all the nearby areas, to the favelas Joaquim Martins, Clovis Dowd, Dos Mineros, Orlando Light, Antonina, Barão, and up to the Fubor Favela. In all those communities, from south to north, from east to west, the reign of Arasau was proclaimed. However, the calm soon ended. The death squads arrived. They were looking for him, because he had also taken control of the Praca Orlando Bonfim Junior Favela, which was located in the far west. This was not a territory like the others, and for a simple reason, because it included one of the few strategic ports of Rio. The one from which all the white powder destined for the city entered. A risky move by Jorge, who to succeed in the enterprise had to face a real battle in which many of his boys died. But in the end, he won and could control a crucial point of drug trafficking in the west of Rio. He no longer had to deal with any intermediary. He sold the raw material to the bosses of the neighboring favelas himself. But the battle fought was only the beginning of the war, because he had taken that kingdom from people much more dangerous and ruthless than him, people who did not joke at all. The young Arasau had made too many enemies and risked losing complete control of his favelas. People said he surely wouldn't live much longer. And this idea spread fast like a superstition among the inhabitants of the various communities, who now considered him a benefactor, a kind of saint, because Arasau spent much of his fortune to help them. With his money, he had repaired schools that were falling apart, but he had also built plumbing and electrical systems and solved many problems caused by sewage. In return, he obtained the support of the population, which shielded him to protect him. The profound purpose of these gestures was related to hidden feelings that he never showed to anyone. Because showing his feelings meant appearing weak to him. Many years before, he had promised himself never to do it again, and so far he had always kept this secret pact with himself. The unseen leaders, enclosed in their colossal white villas overlooking the sea, those villas dreamed of by Jorge since he was a child, had signed a pact to eliminate him. At first, Jorge didn't understand who he was really stealing the port territory from. But he soon discovered that he had gotten involved with the most dangerous criminals. The ones without names, unsuspecting, who dressed in elegant Italian suits and ran their trades from luxurious offices in the city center. They never got their hands dirty, paid mercenary killers, always looking for lucrative contracts. The death squads. The pipers playing the magical music of easy money attracted all sorts of people looking for a better future. That music reached ears far from his favelas and made Arasau one of the most wanted men by Brazilian mercenaries. 10,000 reals, that was the bounty on his head. Not bad for a 22-year-old boss. Jorge managed to avoid the assassinations organized by those meticulous killers, only thanks to his cunning. Surviving this long seemed like magic to the people of the favelas, an almost miraculous ability, so much so that many began to call him El Santurasau. He managed to endure another 2 years of this life, but almost every day now, one of his boys was killed in broad daylight in the distant favelas, and these losses created dangerous gaps in the security net surrounding him. The group that had made that pact to eliminate him had many more men than him, as well as mountains of weapons and money. Their plan seemed to be working. They were about to get him. After yet another ambush in which 4 people died, holed up in his fortress, Ara decided to flee. He would leave everything in the hands of his new right-hand man, without revealing his true intentions. His secret treasure, the one he had buried in an old cigar box in the devil's hideout, amounted to 50,000 reals. Those money symbolized his salvation, the chance to start a new life. Since he was a child, he had dreamed of making money, and one day living in a villa by the sea. But as he grew up, his desire to leave Rio, far from the favelas, increased more and more. He listened to the stories of Barbara Rodriguez. Occasionally, he spoke of a place he called paradise. A place where money flowed abundantly, where everything was clean and elegant, everything wonderfully orderly and safe. A place where there was no danger from death squads. He didn't know the real name of this paradise back then, but now he did, and that's where he wanted to go. Everything was arranged. A brand new passport, an airplane ticket, and a visa valid for 1 month. He reached the airport at night in secret, escorted by the motorcycles of his men. The journey went smoothly. Along the way, he stared for a long time at the destination written on the airplane ticket he held in his hand. He read that name, Switzerland, pouring so many hopes into it that he felt euphoric.